Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah?
Can we speak about monkeys?
We're going to talk about monkeys, really?
Yeah. We're going to talk about monkeys. We're going to talk about a study that was done at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta.
You didn't give me a chance to do my joke.
What's the joke?
I was going to say, go bananas.
Oh.
Go ahead, go nuts.
I wish I had not given you a chance to do your joke. Yeah, we're talking about, of course, it's the Restaurant Guys, so it has to do with food. But it's pretty interesting. They did a study where they looked at what a community of rhesus monkeys at the Primate Research Center in Atlanta, how they ate. And they found that in normal times with normal monkey food, dominant females ordinarily eat a little more than subordinate females. The lower status monkeys are able to get as much food as they want, but normally they seem to have less of a desire to eat, and they've always posited that it's because of the higher stress levels of being a subordinate monkey. You know, you got to give up your chair, the other guy can take the banana away from you.
Anytime he wants.
A lot of stress, exactly.
But seriously, one of the things that they talk about is the stress level of the monkey is basically, and there was a great article by John Tierney in the New York Times, talking about, you know, how that monkey is basically always looking over its shoulder because it is a subordinate to the other monkeys.
Well,
in the group.
But they changed the paradigm around. A guy named Mark Wilson, he's a neuroscientist at Emory University. They installed feeders with a constant supply, 24 hours, of banana-flavored pellets. It's kind of the monkey equivalent to a Dove bar. And once those, like, basically monkey junk food was available, the low-status monkeys started to develop an appetite.
Started eating more.
This is reported in the New York Times. After the junk food was introduced, the paradigm switched, and the lower status monkeys began to eat significantly more calories than their social superiors. And you want to hear something else that's strangely parallel to humans? The more stressed subordinate monkeys, the superior monkeys would eat the junk food during the day, but at night really wouldn't touch it, and the subordinate monkeys ate it
All night long. Well, during the day and at night, whereas the other monkeys didn't.
And so why do we care about this? They were trying to insight.
Right. Tie together stress level and how stressed we are with how we eat and how that actually cause a chemical reaction that makes us feel better.
And they're trying to see what implications this has for human junk food binges. But, you know, with humans, we have so many more things going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that the monkeys weren't choosing junk food because they couldn't find healthier fare, because it was available. We know they weren't seduced by commercials, because, well, they don't have any commercials. and we know they weren't seduced by fashion magazines or body image or any of that stuff. They just, when they were more stressed, they ate more junk food. They didn't eat more good food, they ate more junk food. And that's pretty interesting.
Well, I think it's really interesting. And one of the things that the article talks about is that there's some kind of blocker to stress responses. There have been studies done on rodents that show that high-calorie foods actually do reduce the release of stress hormones like cortisol in rodents by eating high calorie foods, and maybe there's some type of connection like that, certainly in these monkeys and perhaps in human beings as well.
Well, the other thing that happens is when we eat those junk food, it sort of opens like a dopamine receptor. It's kind of a pleasure pathway to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're really stressed out, and what they say is people who are under constant stress, they have diminished ability to feel happy. Because
mm-hmm.
you're stressed all the time. So for the same reasons, and in the Times article, they talk about a similar study that was done among subordinate monkeys with cocaine, and they found out that the subordinate monkeys would, when given the opportunity to take cocaine, took it much more often. And they think that may be related to the fact that the stressed-out monkeys have,
diminished receptors.
Diminished receptors, diminished ability to get happy, and
mm-hmm.
this can open those receptors. There's a doctor named Deborah Zellner. She's a psychologist at Montclair State right here in New Jersey. She studied men and women in an interesting and related way, people were given puzzles and brought into a room, and on the tables were potato chips, M&Ms, peanuts, and red grapes. Now, they found in the human study that the stress affected the sexes differently. Women given solvable puzzles and anagrams ate more grapes than M&Ms, where women who were given unsolvable anagrams, who presumably had higher stress, always went for the M&Ms.
Not always, but yes, a much greater degree.
My personal life, I totally see that. What's funny is the men reacted differently, and they don't have it down quite why. There are a couple of theories. They say the men ate more of the high-fat snacks when they were not under stress. And they posit two things. One is because the men who got the easy anagrams had more time to eat, and therefore went for the M&Ms. And the other is that they're men. They don't really care. One of the things they say...
That's a lie.
Well, one of the things they say is that more women tend to be on diets, so when women binge, they
really broke it. You know, there's a lot to this study, and let's face it, okay? Francis and I, we have a lot of great food available to us all the time. But if you put a bowl of M&Ms in front of us...
We're going to eat it.
We're going to reach. We're going to reach for those bad foods. The more available these foods that are bad for us are, and the more stress you're under, it is, and I think this study concludes that it's a natural monkey reaction, and I think we can maybe take it the next,
but if
the
it's
next
hard,
step.
If it's hardwired
farther,
into the monkey, it's
there's a good chance that it's hardwired into us, that under stress, you're going to reach for something that's probably a worse choice.
Yeah.
And I know I do it. Yeah. I mean, I know for a fact that when I make worse choices under stress than I do when I'm not under stress.
Well, and it's not just worse choices. It's why do we make those particular choices? Because frankly, if I am under, you know, there are times when I'm like, you know, this is a beautiful day. I feel great. Hey, there's an ice cream store. Let's go have an ice cream. But there are times when I think to myself, you know, I really need to stop by Thomas Sweet and stop and get a blended. And you know what? I'm not
because a blended will make me feel better. And that's really true. And sometimes a blended just makes you feel better. And I don't think that we have to go very far from these studies to think about it logically.
Actually,
we know that chocolate sometimes can make us feel better. We know that a delicious blended can make us feel better.
You know what I hate you for? You know what else we don't have to go very far for? We don't have to go very far out of our way on the way back to the restaurant to stop at Thomas
Sweet
and get a blend-in.
That's very true. Sad but true.
For those of you outside the Central Jersey area, Thomas Sweet is a local ice cream store where they blend in. Oh, it's sort of like what's that creamery? The creamery that blends all the stuff into your ice cream in the block.
Like Ben and Jerry's, you mean?
No, the store, Cold Stone.
Cold Stone, I see.
It's sort of like Cold Stone Creamery, but with good ice cream.
But with really good ice cream.
And really good ice cream, and they blend it for you right there. We're stopping on the way back. 100% certain.
We're in separate cars. I'm not going.
And
you can't
make
me.
I'm not particularly stressed today, but just for me, also, there's the whole talking about it. Like, if monkeys understood and we were talking about
right,
the banana
monkeys,
pellets.
If monkeys were able to discuss banana pellets
that
for half
be,
an hour.
That's what you said. They should listen to the radio show where we talk about banana pellets
and see if it makes them eat more banana pellets. I like the way you're thinking.
Well, so if you guys at Thomas Sweet are listening, we'll be there in just a short bit. We have a wonderful guest today. Dr. Daphne Miller is coming on the show. Her book is called The Jungle Effect. It's about indigenous diets around the world. Very different indigenous diets. Some are all meat and fish and no vegetables. Some are a lot of vegetables, very little meat. But she's found that all of these indigenous diets are healthier for you than what we eat. And we'll try to discuss with her what exactly is the commonality there and how that may work.
So, no M&Ms.
No M&Ms. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of course, of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Dr. Daphne Miller. She is the author of The Jungle Effect. A doctor discovers the healthiest diets from around the world and why they work and how to bring them home.
Dr. Daphne Miller, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I have to say the book is phenomenal and phenomenally interesting. It challenges a lot of people's views about what we should be eating and why. What made you decide to go to the jungles and talk to us about the people that you chose to study and what diets you chose to study and what maybe we learned from them?
Absolutely. You know, like many big adventures in one's life, this one started with one specific story, and it was in my office, in my medical office in San Francisco, with a lovely woman named Angela. And Angela was like a bunch of my patients, all wrapped up in one woman. She was starting to have high blood pressure and diabetes. She'd gained about 30 pounds. Her knees were hurting her. She was depressed. And she came in and told me the most remarkable story. She told me that about 6 months earlier, she had gone back to her native village in the jungle in Brazil to visit extended family and had spent a couple months there. And while she was there, all her symptoms that she experienced in San Francisco started to get better. Her knees felt better. She lost weight. Her mood improved. Her blood pressure went down. And then she came back to San Francisco, and everything started to go bad again. And she was in my office trying to figure out why things were so good there and so bad here. And as luck will have it, guess who ended up in the jungle 6 months later? I did. And what happened was I took this crazy volunteer job down there in a very remote clinic that wasn't terribly far from Angela's village. And while I was there, I started to notice some of the same transitions happening both in my body and in the bodies of the volunteers that I was working with down there, the other American volunteers. And what was most remarkable was I was working in this tiny little remote village where people were coming in with snake bites, machete wounds, you know, things you don't really see every day here in San Francisco.
Your average everyday New York City
exactly. But I didn't see one case of diabetes or high blood pressure or cancer or depression. I mean, things that are my bread and butter in my daily medical life. And that was so remarkable, and I really started to look more closely at what the difference was. And it really has to do with the food. I mean, you know, sure, the way of life is different there. Maybe they exercise more than we do, although, you know, a lot of the volunteers that were down there would exercise a lot in their daily life up here. But the foods were so dramatically different. They were locally grown. The recipes used spices that made sense with the foods that came directly out of the river or the jungle, or the animals range freely right there. And there's a whole intricate way of eating that had developed over hundreds of thousands of years in that region, and that made sense. And it really catapulted me around the world looking for diets that were associated with people who had lots of health and lots of longevity, so that I could bring the secrets back to us here in the United States.
I mean, it just has occurs to me in reading your book and obviously doing this radio show for years and running restaurants, it's a more logical way to eat.
It's a more logical way to eat. And the thing about it is that, unfortunately, people are like, well, you know, that just means eating fresh and local, right? The problem is that we have gotten so confused here in the United States, we don't even know what whole foods are anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of the book is really trying to explain to people what is a whole food. You know, every single bit of packaging that we buy now says whole grain on it or natural, and 99% of that stuff is hooey. You know?
So the whole grain Pop-Tarts I've been eating are not really, that wouldn't fall into your category of whole food?
Well, you know, probably not, especially if there's more than two ingredients on that package. Are there more than two ingredients on that package?
Well, a whole food then is basically a food that doesn't have a list of ingredients.
And especially ingredients that you can't pronounce,
right,
or that sound suspiciously like sugar, even things that say natural rice sweetener. Believe it or not, that is sugar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Natural brown rice sweetener, that's sugar too. But certainly things that, you know, are completely unpronounceable. And I tell people, you know, to be safe, really restrict yourself to things that with four ingredients that you can pronounce and that don't sound like sugar or refined grains.
Well, and let's talk about the fact that it wasn't specifically, well, one of the things that you specifically found when you went there was that while the life expectancy may or may not have been longer, you found that, you know, you might be more apt to die from being eaten by a lion or cut by a machete, but there was just a complete absence of the Western diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was really, in each place that I traveled to where they were truly eating a traditional diet, that was the case. Now, things are changing, and we are just so capable of infiltrating even the deepest, darkest jungles with our Western food. So I was encountering Coca-Cola in the middle of the Cameroonian rainforest, and Japan is now, you know, has a McDonald's on every corner, even in the more traditional areas. So, you know, these traditional diets that have so much to teach us and that are so healing are rapidly becoming extinct.
Well, and we can talk about perhaps if we could combine the best of eating a traditional diet or a diet that makes sense, and also keeping our minimal contact with lions and machetes that we have up in the West, we could live a really long time.
What an idea. What an idea. We'll
take a quick break and talk more with Dr. Daphne Miller. Her book is The Jungle Effect. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick. And its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And our guest is Dr. Daphne Miller. Her book is called The Jungle Effect, about how eating certain diets can eliminate Western diseases. And we were talking right before the break about how Western diets are encroaching upon even the most remote areas of traditional diets. I remember a friend of mine did a veterinary internship for her VMD in Africa, and she worked in a village where they had no electricity. There's no electricity for miles in any direction. There was one electrical appliance in the center of the village, and it was a Coke machine, and it was lit. It was the only electric light, and it was the only refrigeration. And you know, it was a power cord that had been run for basically 70 miles to get to the
to Coke indoctrinate machine. This culture into Coca-Cola, so that it would become one of the staples, one of the very first parts of Western culture that they saw.
How at risk are these native diets?
Oh, terribly so. And that, I honestly sometimes feel like if I were to set out to write The Jungle Effect 5 years from now, I wouldn't have even been able to find the stories that are in that book. If you notice, a lot of the people that I interview throughout the chapters are older, and those are the ones who are holding on to these wonderful traditions. And the truth is that there's so many things that were surprises to me as I traveled from West Africa to Japan to Iceland to Mexico. Things that, you know, I've been studying nutrition for years and teaching nutrition for years, and I really thought I had it all down and had it all straight. But after, you know, talking to these folks and looking at how they truly do eat, it really gave me a whole new set of ideas that I wanted to bring home in this book. I mean, for example, in Iceland, where they have these really surprisingly low rates of depression, given the fact that they're so northernmost, you know, and the other...
A lot of darkness. No sunlight.
A lot of darkness, you know, lots of ice floes, and yet these surprisingly low rates of depression and incredible longevity. And yet, I went there, and I'm interviewing the Icelanders, and they're telling me how much they hate vegetables. Now, you know, I've been taught forever that, you know, vegetables are great for you, you should eat as many of them as you can, so on and so forth. That's true.
Dr. Miller, we're going to leave that right there as what we call a cliffhanger. To come back to the next segment, and we'll find out how maybe you don't have to eat all your vegetables after all. Maybe your mom was wrong. Back in a moment with Daphne Miller after the news. The Jungle Effect is her book. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're speaking with Dr. Daphne Miller, author of The Jungle Effect, The Doctors Discovers the Healthiest Diets from Around the World and Why They Work and How to Bring Them Home.
Dr. Miller, just a moment ago, you were telling us that we do not have to eat all our vegetables.
Well, we need to be more creative in how we eat our vegetables, because the reality is there's an awful lot of vegetable haters out there, and I want them to be healthy, too. And if you look at the Icelanders, they actually teach us some really important lessons about how you can get all your antioxidants, these powerful nutrients, and maybe not be a big salad muncher. The Icelanders, it turns out, they hate salad. They hate a lot of greens that we're taught we're supposed to eat every day, and they can't even grow them on the island.
I was
going to
say, because they can only... Because they can only have them 2 weeks a year.
Yeah, but then you look in their diet, and they're actually, A, getting tons of nutrients by eating game and fish that that have eaten well themselves. It turns out if you eat meat that has been fed, a pasture-fed or free-range, it will give you a lot of the vitamins, vitamin C and so on, that you normally get through vegetables. Now, I'm not a big proponent of eating tons of meat, and that's not what I learned to do as I traveled around the world. Most of these cultures eat very little meat, but that's one example. Another example is that they eat things like cabbage and the new potatoes that are grown fresh from the earth, which are much more nutritious than our mass-produced potatoes, and barley and blueberries. And sure enough, when you test their blood, they're filled with Icelanders' blood, they're filled with antioxidants, but they're not big salad munchers. Mm. You're not going to see them sitting down to a big plate of greens. So, you know, you have to forgive yourself if you're not, you know, the biggest salad fan in the world. Start to look for other ways of getting these nutrients, and I give you great recipes for how to do that.
Well, and basically, one of the things that you've said here is it's not just important what you eat. It is also important the things that you eat, what they eat, is very, very important.
Yeah.
Or what they're grown in, exactly.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference to the nutrient content to the things that we're eating.
You know, it's funny. Yeah. We put on our menu, we just added on Stage Left menu, we added a steak section. We have a big demand for steak. And so we added an addition to our, you know, 7-course tasting menu and so maybe somewhat more refined the side of the menu. We added a steak menu, and we're able to get for the first time, we've been battling to get a consistent supply, and we finally from Painted Hills Farms have gotten a consistent supply of very high quality grass-fed beef. So two of the steaks on our menu are grass-fed. And so we're getting more and more experience, and we've always had some, but we have more and more daily experience with grass-fed beef as opposed to corn-fed beef. And it looks different, the fat looks different, it tastes different,
it cooks
delicious,
differently.
And it's got to be different for you. A cow is not a cow is not a cow. And
absolutely.
I think
it's much richer in omega-3 fats. But what I would ask for your steak eaters is that they treat that as a feast.
Yep.
You know, because that's the thing, is that in most of these cultures, sure, occasionally they do have their slab of meat. But for most days of the week, it's a simple meal that uses meat more like a spice. And that's something we really can learn from. I mean, there's many things as I traveled around in terms of lessons, but an important one was to use meat more as a spice. I mean, it has a rich flavor. You put it in anything, it makes a food taste terrific, whether it's pork or you know, beef or chicken. But it does not have to be a huge hunk in the middle of the plate. We're one of the few cultures that does that.
Well, in one of the things I found interesting about the book was you didn't go to all these indigenous cultures that where people live for a long time and find that they all ate the same stuff. You found that they ate very different, even different categories of stuff, like the Icelanders who didn't even eat vegetables. But what was the commonality in all the different places with all the different kinds of diets? What are the lessons in your book that binds these very healthy diets together?
Yeah, well, I try and boil it down to 9 key points just to make it simple for folks. But certainly the way that they approach meat, as I just mentioned, the idea of fresh and local and whole grains. And then what was fascinating to me and surprising was that all these cultures really enjoy fermented foods, which is something we don't eat a lot of in the United States. Foods that, like yogurt or sauerkraut, that have been cultured and that have bacteria in them that are actually very good for your intestine, good for your immune system, probably even anti-cancer, and help with allergies and so on. And we have so little fermented foods traditionally in what we eat here in the U.S. All of these diets had that.
People think of pickles as fermented, and traditionally pickles
but unfortunately, the way most of our pickles are made for commercial use here in the U.S., and I won't name any big companies that are making them that way, but, you know.
But we know who they are.
They know who they are, and their name starts with an H. But they do not truly use the brining fermenting process. So buy more local small brands of pickles. Bubba's, B-U-B-B-A, is one that I see truly uses the lactic acid, you know, brining method. And then there's wonderful recipes for doing it yourself. There's actually a book called Wild Fermentation by Sundar Katz.
Yeah, I have that book. It's great. And I'll tell you,
I'll just drink more beer, though.
Even the beer, unfortunately, most of it doesn't give you that unless you're, you know, because here we also add so many preservatives. Mm-hmm. We pasteurize, we homogenize, we, you know, add nitrates and phosphates, and at the end of the day, you don't have very much that's actually alive in our food.
I Francis and I have spent a good deal of time talking about pasteurization and homogenization and how those processes were important processes at the turn of the century to change to kill a lot of the diseases and to stop a lot of diseases. But they're not as important today as they once were, and yet so many things are still pasteurized and homogenized, and maybe we should be moving away from that instead of farther towards it and super pasteurizing.
Yeah, well, it became an important process when we started pooling all our foods, when people no longer started buying from the local milk guy, but it all got dumped into one huge truck and sent to Clover or whatever other big... Then, of course, you didn't want one guy's milk
right.
to taint,
one,
you know.
Where one sick cow could taint thousands and thousands of gallons of milk.
Exactly, but now that we are going back to local, know your food and make sure it has a face. Mm-hmm. In terms of a person, that those things are not so important. And certainly the risks of unpasteurized milk from a reputable producer are way overblown, and there's so many health benefits to it.
Especially when we can test for a lot of those pathogens now. We can know if a milk is coming from a tainted source.
Absolutely. So, you know, you have to make sure it's a reputable producer, but the taste is completely different. I just gave my kids a taste test the other day, and it was amazing. The unpasteurized one, hands down.
Raw milk is the best.
We had another doctor, a homeopathic physician named Dr. Ron Schmid, who's at the head of the raw milk movement in the country. And he prescribes milk as a curative, raw milk as a curative for a lot of different ailments. Do you find tremendous health benefits to raw milk?
I definitely find that a lot of people who have allergies to pasteurized milk do okay with raw milk, including, you know, people from other countries who grew up on unpasteurized milk and come here and get sick when they start drinking our milk.
Huh. You know, it's a fascinating topic, and there's actually a lot of debate about it now. The corporations are putting tremendous resources trying to keep raw milk illegal, trying to keep your ability to choose raw milk.
For instance, here in New Jersey, raw milk is illegal to sell.
Interesting.
But there is also the Weston Price Foundation does a lot of work in trying to make raw milk available to through reputable sources and legal. And we think it should be. I'm all for choice. And, you know, very often in the way that our food is produced, people want to irradiate and require food to be pasteurized and irradiated. And large companies often want to do this because they can have otherwise fairly unsanitary practices or unsavory practices if they know in the end it's going to be zapped with radiation or boiled.
And yeah, but the problem is those practices in the long run are what's killing us. They might not kill us the next morning. We might not wake up with the runs or a stomach ache. But the problem is that when you take, for example, oils and turn them into trans fats, or you take, you know, foods and add nitrates and phosphates to them, that's what's giving us the cancers and the heart disease and the, you know, and the diabetes and, you know, 20, 30 years down the road.
Well, and just... And from an aesthetic perspective, you know, if we require that, you know, fecal counts be kept to an absolute minimum in milk, because if it, you know, it goes out in the milk, it can make people sick, I'm all for that. But if we say, well, the way we're going to take care of that is we can be less stringent about that because we're going to zap it anyway. You know, whether it's sterilized poo or just unsterilized poo, I don't want it in my milk, you know? And why the big agribusiness concerns and food processors want to require everyone to do it is because they know the small farmer, says, listen, my milk is unpasteurized and therefore it's always been clean.
Mm-hmm.
And that they'll get a premium for it. And the big companies are trying to keep it from having a level playing field for people who want to make you healthy food.
I think there's so many things at this point in terms of regulation that are at the disadvantage of the small producers. But despite that, we're seeing a very, you know, silver lining to this cloud where they're starting to make a comeback.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Across the country, I've talked to small farmers who are, you know, putting aside their pesticides and are really starting to make a living producing wonderful locally grown food that's being appreciated by folks.
And
it's cheaper, too.
Well,
it's a great thing.
And that's because of people like you and the work that you do. I think it's because somewhat of this show, and it's mostly because of all of you who are listening to this show, and that's good work that you're doing out there. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Dr. Daphne Miller about her book, The Jungle Effect. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:47.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of course, stage left and Captain Lombardi. We're talking with Dr. Daphne Miller about her book, The Jungle Effect. One of the things in your travels that you alluded to earlier, Dr. Miller, was that you found in places where the Western diet has in recent years encroached into what was a traditional diet, and you have what is perhaps the clearest example of the benefits of the traditional diet. You have very old, healthy people who still eat the traditional diet sort of coexisting with their fatter 30, 40-year-old, 20-year-old kids who are not healthy. Can you talk to us about some examples of that?
Absolutely. Throughout The Jungle Effect, I talk about this paradox that you see within the generations. I mean, with the family that I interviewed here in San Francisco who kind of sent me on my trip to Okinawa, there was a set of twins who were in their 40s, late 40s, who were eating all kinds of processed food, TV dinners, and also eating Japanese-American food, which, by the way, hardly resembles the traditional Japanese food.
Whereas, happens a lot in cultures where the Americanization causes them to be less good for you.
Exactly, and including the fact that they were eating Spam, and which is sort of this interesting reinterpretation of some of the pork that's used in traditional Asian cooking. But right in the same house with them was their grandmother, who was just ancient, but still walking several blocks to the farmer's market, buying all their foods, coming home and cooking them in the same kitchen with them. And one of the things that happened for them as I went on my travels and brought back my stories to them was for them to just look 2 feet away at what their grandmother was doing and to have a renewed interest in that. Because they were both developing diseases in their 40s, breast issues and prostate issues that, you know, were not experienced in their grandmother's generation at all.
And it's just one generation is all it takes. One.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And story after story like that, and of people whose grandparents, I tell about Yorgos, who was an olive grower on Crete, whose grandparents, or sorry, his great-grandparents each lived to well past 100, and his grandfather died in his late 90s falling off a ladder building a house. And yet Yorgos himself had moved to Canada to become a pilot, and there he'd just eaten meat and tons of processed oils, and he ended up with a triple bypass in his 40s. And that was enough for him to move his whole family back to the olive farm on Crete and completely change his way of life. And by the time I'd met him, he was in his 50s and looking great, looking 10 years younger, hadn't had a single heart problem again, you know, was exercising, working on the farm, and eating a traditional Cretan diet, and had really changed his health around. But, you know, these stories, I heard one after the other, and it really started to look like a pattern, you know.
We only have about a minute left, but can you give our listeners some advice in sort of the Reader's Digest version, besides, of course, the advice to buy your book, which is something that we do advise they do, but just, you know, some rules to live by that they can ascribe to in our American culture.
Absolutely. And, you know, the first thing is to start with baby steps, because it's so hard to change your diet. And if you do big things, you don't stick to them. So I really give stepwise approaches with the recipes so you can do little things. But starting to cook is a very big step one. It's so hard in our busy culture. Starting to eat local, starting to eat whole grains, using your meat as a spice, starting to think about interesting spices that are healthy and fermented foods. Those are all some of the first places to go. And then to start to enjoy your food more. Eat it with your family. Don't eat it in the car. Don't eat it in the supermarket itself or in front of the TV. Eat it slowly and mindfully. And these are all beginning steps to making a difference in your health, and that I learned as I traveled.
And if you'd like to find some of the advanced steps, you can pick up the book by Dr. Daphne Miller, The Jungle Effect, The Doctor Discovers the Healthiest Diets from Around the World, Why They Work, and How to Bring Them Home. Dr. Miller, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Dr. Miller.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. You know, it's funny, when in reading this book, and it is a wonderful book, in reading the book, I am really amazed. She talked about something we didn't really get a chance to talk about. She talks about nutrient splitting.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how it's not going to work, and how it's inherently unsuccessful, where she talks about, well, how many grams of fat are you going to have in your day? And if you spend your days figuring out how many grams of fat, how many calories from fat, how many calories from carbohydrates, how many complex carbohydrates, I can have 20 grams of this. It's just not a way that anybody in any culture
mm-hmm.
eats.
Or successfully eats.
Because it's just not a math problem. It's mm-hmm. not how we, you know, it's a very clinical, that's how we take medicine, that's not how we eat. It's about changing the fundamental philosophy of how you eat. You know, do I eat whole foods that I know are good for me? Do I have meat once in a while? Do I have...
I don't. I have meat all the time.
I do, too.
No, I love meat.
I do, too, but I try to eat grass-fed beef whenever I can now.
Yeah.
I try to know where, you know, stuff that comes from local farms. I try very hard to make sure that my chicken is organic and certainly doesn't have hormones and antibiotics in it.
And we touched on this in the interview, but what you're eating, what it eats, where it grows. These things are very, very important, A, to the nutrient content, but also to a lot of the problems that we're encountering in our daily lives come from the what our animals are eating, what our fruits and produce and vegetables are grown in.
Now, and if you want to look at the, and also how processed our foods are.
Obviously.
But it's really beyond question, and corporate agribusiness will try and obscure this fact. Not only do we say, okay, well, in the West, we have these diseases that they don't have in places where they don't eat this kind of diet. But now, as Western fast food and Western food is being aggressively exported, in cultures when it arrives and people start eating it, they get sick. Mm-hmm. While their parents who still eat the traditional food don't get sick. And they get sick in the exact same ways that we get sick.
And it's absolutely clear. The connection is absolutely clear.
I don't need any more proof than that. Mm-hmm. So go have a tomato that's organically grown, like the ones we have at Stage Left. Hey, listen, I hope that you've enjoyed your time with the Restaurant Guys this hour. I know that we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.